Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
It's Monday, October 7th from HPR2. It's The Conversation. Up this morning, residents in the zone. A North Shore homeowner battles on to keep the footprint. Meanwhile, the Coa Ridge rezoning bill comes up for a second vote this week. A Mililani board chair says that might be okay, but the traffic plan isn't.
And the dawning of a new age, not Aquarius, the Anthropocene. We'll talk with a science writer on her way to talk at UH, and then we'll get a preview of this year's Pacific Rim Jazz Festival at the Honolulu Convention Center. Good morning, I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Welcome to The Conversation. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning, Chris.
Unlike the government, we can say that we are at our desks functioning this morning.
Yeah, and if only that could be the case for all, as we're now in day 7 of the partial shutdown. Well, we are open for business, and we're going to continue along. Now, this first conversation shows tenacity isn't dead. Some of the contingent opposing North Shore development have been fighting for 40 years, and they have no plans to give up now. The Ko'olauloa Sustainable Communities Plan goes before the Honolulu City Council's Zoning and Planning Committee in a special hearing in Kahuku tomorrow night. Creighton Mattoon will be there, again, to say that the plan is not sustainable, and he joins us by phone now. Good morning.
Morning, Beth Ann.
You know, it's been a little while since we've talked to you, although we've had several conversations about what's happening on the North Shore. How is it that you've managed to stay in this fight so long?
You want me to give you a clinical psychological explanation for that?
Well, as a former clinical psychologist, I'm sure you could. But just this battle has been such a long time in being fought, and clearly no closer to a resolution now than it was quite a long time ago.
Well, I think basically what drives me and some of the others who are engaged in this struggle is the cultural concept of Malama Aina and Malama Ohana, and this is what drives me anyway.
When you have testified in past, and certainly what you will be doing again tomorrow night, the basis of a lot of the testimony is that this plan doesn't comply with the state, and nor that the Oahu General Plan. And that Ko'olauloa should remain rural.
Correct. In fact, it doesn't comply with the Sustainable Communities Plan either, because in the introduction of it, it says that this is a rural community, and then it proceeds to go on and propose to urbanize a section of the community. And when we're talking about the community, you know, we're talking about the community all the way from Haleiwa to it's Ko'olauloa, obviously, but this plan affects not only Ko'olauloa, but North Shore and Ko'olaupoko. So it's the whole windward side and North Shore that will be affected, and I'll explain that, what I mean about that, because it affects the two-lane Kamehameha Highway and anyone and any community along that highway.
When you say that, you know, the community is affected at large, the plan is only dealing with some in the community who might benefit from it, and that seems to be the underlying opposition to it.
That's correct. More specifically, Communities plan initially was proposed by the Planning Advisory Committee, which was set up by the city itself and through its contracted consultants. And, you know, it represented all the communities in Ko'olauloa and spent 2 years on it and came up with a plan that most of the committee members felt would benefit the entire all the communities within Kolaloa.
We should say that it's not as if all of you are opposed to growth per se, but growth within the confines of the footprint of various organizations now. So that would be in La'ie at BYU, other places including Turtle Bay. Would that be correct?
Yes, I think so. I think that would be correct.
For people who have been watching this for a very long time, as those of you who have been fighting it have been involved with it, it's a very multi-layered and convoluted process and so many different parts of it to begin to understand. How do you try to explain this to the rest of us?
Oh, boy. You know, I guess through discussions and in some instances through visual aids, if you look at a map and look at the areas that are being proposed for development, you get a clearer picture of how certain types of development would affect the surrounding communities. We have to do this consistently and as clearly as possible. I think the hardest people to convince, however, have been the government agencies.
Even though they initially helped with this plan in the first place?
That's correct.
So at this point, I mean, this is one stop along the way. This is not going to be a definitive decision that's going to be made tomorrow night, but it is one step along the way. What happens if it doesn't go your way?
Well, what we've been doing for 40 years, we keep on testifying and presenting what we feel is good evidence, to support the case, so to speak. I know that this meeting on tomorrow night at Kahuku is only one step of the way. As I understand it, the Zoning and Planning Committee won't be making any recommendations, but if they take any kind of vote, it'll be just to move it on to the next step in the process.
But they will be taking public comment.
Yes, that's correct. They will be receiving public comment, which is another interesting area of discussion, Bethan. The developers, have quite a bit of time to present their case, and then testimony are accepted from the audience, and testimonies are restricted to 1 minute apiece. So, it's hard to prove your case in 1 minute, so a lot of people have to say different things, not just repeat the same thing over and over again. So this is the way it has been going on, and I guess this is the way it's going to continue to go on.
Has that forced all of you to really get together, take apart the argument, and parse it out?
Yes, many groups have come together and have accepted certain areas to cover in the most expeditious and economic way, I think, to get the point across.
Well, thanks very much for helping get a couple points across today from the perspective of someone who's been doing it for decades. Thanks a lot.
Can I say one thing?
Very quickly.
We're very quickly. The Defend the Wild Coalition is going to have a rally tomorrow before the meeting. And it'll be at 4 o'clock until 5:30, and it'll be at the Kahuku District Park, and it's across from the Kahuku Sugar Mill. Bethan, I thank you for this opportunity to discuss this with you.
Thanks very much for joining us this morning. Creighton Mattoon was born on the Big Island and is a retired clinical psychologist. He served 30 years as a mental health consultant to the courts and the correction system. His favorite role these days, though, are as grandpa and community activist, especially to oppose North Shore urbanization. The Honolulu City Council Zoning and Planning Committee will take up the issue of North Shore's urbanization again in a special hearing in Kahuku tomorrow night.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR 2. It's 8:14. Coming up, big jazz in a big venue, today's coffee talk. And so you think you pay a lot for gas? Got milk lately? Meanwhile, here's something else to ponder.
Umurokai, Ulanai, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohavai.
To start the week, today's backyard quiz takes us to the historical backyard, so here's a little history. When it was founded in 1955, it was called St. Louis Junior College. Its founders were members of the Marianist Order, the Society of Mary, and from the beginning they had an educational mission. The order had been started by a French Catholic priest who hoped to rebuild the church in the wake of the French Revolution. Its missionaries arrived in the islands in 1883, and eight Marianists assumed the leadership of what is now St. Louis School. When St. Louis Junior College became the four-year coeducational institution it is now, it was given the name of the founder of the Marianist Order. Your easy Monday question, who was he? We'll be back to name names, or, well, at least one, next half hour. Well, here we are. Yes, we are starting another week. And as you know, on Mondays, Bill Sage turns up in a morning spot somewhere on Oahu. Well, today he's at Rocky's Coffee Shop in Waipahu to check out the coffee and the conversation. So what's brewing, Bill?
Aloha. Everything is brewing pretty well over here at Rocky's in Waipahu on Historic Depot Road. And this morning, Danny is with us. And Danny, you've been out of this area for a long time?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And what is your favorite... what's your favorite thing about living in Waipahu area?
It's very good.
Uh-huh. So what, are you going to be taking the rail when they finish that?
No.
You just like to take the bus or walk?
Yes.
Okay, and are you retired now?
Yes.
What did you used to do?
I work for Goodwill.
Okay, and so now you are just taking it easy in the morning right here?
Yes.
This is one of your favorite spots, right?
Yes.
Looks like everybody in town is here at Rocky's.
Yes.
Okay, well, I'm really, really glad you came on this morning, and this looks like the best place to be in this section of town. So next week, we're going to be up in Manoa Valley, and we'll be at a place called Morning Glass. So until then, keep the coffee flowing and keep the ideas brewing. We'll be back to you in a little bit. Aloha. Thank you, Danny.
Well, good coffee and good jazz frequently go together, and in Hawaii, we home grow both. Hawaii has long since become a jazz destination. It had to happen. Hawaii's place is a crossroads between the mainland and Japan, has kept musicians from both east and west passing through here, and homegrown jazz has been going strong for generations. Michael Paolo is a second-generation Hawaii jazz musician, born to a performing family. Now in his third decade as an international jazz artist himself, he's an impresario with his Pacific Rim Jazz Festival. He's with us this morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Michael.
Man, that sounds good.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Can you pay you another $5?
We should just bask in the glow of that introduction for a while.
That's really nice. Thank you.
What made you want to make the transition from a performer to, well, include being a promoter to your bag of tricks?
Well, you know, I was involved with Dolphin Days, Waikoloa Food and Wine Festival, for a number of years, 15 years on the Big Island. Mm-hmm. And I was instrumental in bringing a lot of the jazz acts to that event. So that's how I got started. And then I helped kind of organize and ideas and everything. And then about 10 years ago, I moved down to an area called Temecula, a lot of wineries. Mm-hmm. And so I decided, with all the knowledge that I had learned from being involved with Dolphin Days, to try to start my own jazz festival. Mm-hmm. So I did, and that's another event I also run in the mainland. And then I got involved with people in different levels doing corporate events and booking entertainment. I've been involved with the Java Jazz Festival for the last 9 years as an artist in residence, bringing a lot of acts from the mainland U.S. over to the festival there. So I kind of helped build that event. So kind of things just happened. I was always good with organizing things, you know, producing music. I mean, it's the same kind of talent where you bring people together.
Right. But not all musicians are good at that.
It's no.
Some musicians have that ability, others do not.
Well, I was joking about my education at St. Louis High School. And the business side, I guess, came naturally. I was always good with numbers, you mm-hmm. know, and that's important, putting together budgets and making sure, you know, you do certain things. And the other aspect is artists always complain when they do shows for other promoters. Well, oh, you never promoted me enough, and you didn't do this, and all that, you know. So I get to be on the other side and really try to take care of those needs firsthand.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of getting at, Michael, because I figured from the artist side, you had to have your own ideas about how to do a show based on your
artist
experience.
Absolutely. Where in my mind, taking care of the artist is first. And utmost, right? Because they are the reason why people come out. You know, promoters have it backwards, right?
Yeah.
They kind of use artists, you know, they're trying to make money, but then at the same time, you know, there's a bottom line where you know, they don't want to take care of the needs of the artists properly. So
I've often wondered why some promoters don't seem to understand you get a better show if the artists are happy.
Most definitely.
You will get some kind of show even if they're miserable.
Yeah,
but you get a better show if they're happy, right?
You know, so I'm happy. I have a great rapport with a lot of great artists, and thus the end benefit is the audience, because you know, because of those relationships, I can bring a lot of these artists to Hawaii to perform, where otherwise, you know, most people couldn't afford it.
Are they some of these people you've played with?
All of them.
Yeah, it seems that way.
Yeah, all of them. So. You know, after being in the mainland for 30 years and touring, of course, my first start was with Al Jarreau, touring mm-hmm. with him in the 80s, and I started meeting, you know, all the quality musicians and entertainers, you know, because of that relationship, being on the stage with Al. And I parlayed that into long-term relationships where I can actually call a lot of these artists my friends that mm-hmm. I've been working over the years. So for me, it's actually a pleasure, you know, bringing them to where I grew up, Hawaii, which is a beautiful place. And in fact, I had Norman Brown here, great guitarist, right?
Yeah.
You know who he is.
And
it was kind of a chore trying to convince the manager to bring Norman over. And he was like, oh, no, you know, I'm busy. And finally he got here. And when he left, he was saying, hey, man, I should pay you for being here. Well, so that's a great, great thing, because Hawaii is a beautiful place.
Yeah. And that's going to build on itself for each succeeding show, right? That word of mouth is going to get around.
Well, it's a small community, so they go back and they talk and they tell their friends and everybody, and now they're clamoring, oh, Mike, they're all, you know, emailing me, Facebooking me, hey, when are you going to take me to Hawaii again, right? So it's nice,
I was telling some musician friends about your headline artist, Bobby Caldwell, mm-hmm. and immediately, as soon as I said the name, people started singing this little melody from his best-known tune, right?
Well, yeah, Bobby's a legendary R&B pop jazz vocalist. Yeah. Still tours, and you know, of course, he'll be at our festival November 2nd, you know, Pacific Rim Jazz Festival. And you know, I've worked with Bobby a number of times. You know,
what was the common thread in the artists that you picked?
The common thread is they're all nice people. And you know, I mean, there's a lot of artists out there that you don't want to work with, you know. And even though they're great, they're successful, but, you know, they just don't, they're hard to work
too
with.
Too much drama?
Too much drama,
by
too much
By the time
stress.
You get them back on the plane, yeah. you're like, yeah, I exactly. never want to see them again.
Because, and that's another aspect that I try to have at my events is that everybody's nice, we all get along, you know, and there's no drama, you know, yeah.
You're going to have some of these different headliners kind of interacting with each other?
Well, actually, yeah, they're all playing. You know, I have Keiko Matsui and Mindy Hebert and Brian Simpson. They're all, and Greg Kourakos, you know, they're all playing in the same group together.
So somebody will do a featured tune and then step back and play along with somebody else
yes,
on,
exactly.
on their featured
tune. So that's how I like to run these things where I take a given number of artists and then I get a, you know, a house band, mm-hmm. Incidentally, of really, really great musicians. Yeah. I got Ricky Lawson, drummer, coming in, Ready Freddy Washington coming in to play bass, you know, and so the backup band is always quality guys.
Those guys are monsters.
Yeah. And then I throw them together, like, you know, I'm putting Bobby Caldwell and Sheila Eat on stage together along with pianist Brian Simpson. So they
That's
honestly
make it
they,
really
they get a unique life. Experience of just not one artist with his band.
Yeah.
You know, which is just kind of automatic pilot sometimes.
Yeah,
but when
exactly.
you get different entities and you put them together, there's a different energy that happens. And that's going to be happening at our festival on November 2nd.
Well, yeah. Michael, thanks very much for coming. That sounds really exciting. Good to have you on the show.
Can they tell them where to go? Or,
We'll send them that way through the website.
PacificRimJazzFestival.com, right?
Gotcha. Michael Paolo is the producer of the 4th Annual Pacific Rim Jazz Festival at the Hawaii Convention Center, November 2nd. And details are at hpr2.org.
It may be the first Monday for October, but it's the 9th term for the Supreme Court of John Roberts. What does the court face this term? And how are the divisions on the court likely to be tested, confirmed, or shaken up? Is it going to be more 5-4s or more 9-0s for the Roberts Court? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
Anyone who shops for groceries knows that we get to pay sky-high prices for many common items. On the mainland, the average price for a gallon of milk is, get this, $3.45. But you'll pay almost double that for a gallon of Metal Gold at Foodland on Oahu. What gives? CivilBeat.com editor Patty Epler is back today with a real dose of reality as CivilBeat continues its look at the cost of living in Hawaii. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
You know, the idea of paying, you know, $6.30 a gallon for milk kind of puts it in perspective about what we pay for gasoline. But there seems to be no real, you know, reason, except for maybe transportation costs and a few other things, why that milk is so much more expensive here. I know you're starting to look at common items in the Living Hawaii series.
Yes, this is another installment in our sort of deep dive look into the cost of living in Hawaii and why it's the way it is and if there's anything that can be done about it. So we did decide to take a look at milk, which is something that everyone buys here. And it was really interesting, the difference in price. Even like Whole Foods in Manhattan in New York City is only like $3.29 a gallon, and we're paying, as you noted, $6.29 here. I know. So one of the things that we were told is, of course, that transportation does add to the cost, and we'll be taking a much closer look at transportation and shipping charges as we get further along in this series. Another thing is that there are federal requirements related to interstate shipments, such as that milk has to be pasteurized before it's packaged and shipped. That adds more to the cost. But really, the bottom line is we don't have a lot of dairies here. 20 years ago, there were, I believe, dozens of dairies in Hawaii. But now we're down to two. So, and the way the state kind of sets a floor for what companies like Metal Gold have to pay the farmers for milk really drives the cost of local milk up to about $9 a gallon rather than that $6.29 we're talking about. And so there's really just so many factors involved. We get our milk from California.
Right, I was going to ask you about that.
Also sets a floor.
Yeah, but I mean, because it comes from California, still though, if you look at what California milk is, it's still a little bit better than, you know, $4.40 or so a gallon there. So those additional $2 or $3 that we get to pay per gallon all is because of transportation and federal requirements coming into Hawaii?
That's what we're being told now. We're going to be taking a much closer look at milk, especially sort of examining this sort of price control that the state of Hawaii sets on it. We pay $35 per 100 pounds of milk. That's what the producers have gotten. That's double. Even in California, where there's price controls, farmers in California only get $17 per 100 pounds of milk in that sort of price control structure. So we want to take a closer look at that as well. But right now, it looks like shipping and some of the federal requirements are what's driving up the cost to get it here from California.
Well, I'm particularly interested in what you're going to find out about the pasteurization, because isn't milk pasteurized in California too? I mean, before it's packaged?
Yes, you would think so, and that it needs to be shipped, you know, across state lines or whatever. It's the same as here. So
okay,
yeah,
well, we'll look forward to more on the series and why we get to pay more for milk and a whole bunch of other things. Thanks, Patty.
Thank you.
Patty Epler is the editor for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, who hasn't had back pain at one time or another?
Well, that would be very few of us. 80% of us will have this at some point in our lifetime, even if it's just for a few days.
And so what do you do about it?
Well, we're going to talk today about first what you do if you have the pain, and then also what do you do to make sure that you don't injure your back? There are some great techniques and exercises that anybody can do at home. Don't need a gym, don't need any fancy equipment, but the stronger you make your back before you have an injury, the less likely you are to have the pain.
The idea is
the same exercises you would do if you've already had the pain.
So the idea is to reinforce, even if a muscle is hurting, you kind of reinforce the muscles around it, yeah?
Absolutely. And in fact, there are some stretches and things. It's very hard because our low back is an area that we don't usually get a lot of exercise or strength training for, other than just standard walking and things. But boy, you lift up something as light as a laundry basket, and you might twist your back and throw it out. And we're going to talk about how you can prevent that so that it just doesn't happen to you.
Yeah, lifting's a thing a lot of people do wrong, isn't it, Kathy?
It is. Haven't we all done that and been happy that we didn't have a problem?
Exactly.
We're not going to be that lucky forever.
Well, we'll find out how to keep it safe then. Thanks a lot, Kathy.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
The foresight and commitment of station members are helping to build HPR into its network with statewide reach. We gratefully acknowledge Kent and Sharon Lucien of Honolulu, John Camphor of Wahiawa, and Karen Tanabe of Honolulu for their early gifts for Celebration 2013. Station membership is a choice. Are you a member? New members most often join at the $10 a month True Believer level. Just follow the support link at hpr2.org and make your pledge of support. It'll shorten the drive that starts next week. Wednesday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We're coming up to 8:33. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. Today we're looking at a few rezoning battles, and in the fight over Coa Ridge, some might call Dick Poirier's a mitigating voice. He's the longtime chairman of the Mililani Neighborhood Board and a former state planning program manager. He says the traffic report done in 2009 and paid for by the developer is flawed. He's not opposed to development. He just wants the city to follow correct procedures. And Dick Poirier joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. But it seems, though, that this fight, this ongoing idea that development has to understand that it's going to take a lot of traffic issues with it, seems not to have been looked at as completely as you would have liked.
Exactly. Well, there are a couple of problems. The first is the planning problem. The county has a planning process, as you know, where they have a general plan that looks at the total island and comes in with some general goals and policies in terms of quality of life, population distribution, growth, et cetera. Then under that layer, the general plan layer, there's a series of eight development plans, one of which is the Central Oahu Sustainable Communities Plan. Another would be the Ever Development Plan. And these plans get more specific in terms of policy, specific actions, what goes into agriculture, what is going to be urbanized, et cetera. And what the problem there is that the development plans are supposed to be updated every 5 years. Last time the Central Oahu Sustainability Community Plan was updated was in 2002, so it's almost 11 years since that's been done. And the problem is after 11 years, traffic does get worse, people get more cognizant of it, et cetera.
And that part wasn't brought into that plan that was looked at in 2009. I mean, is that what you're saying?
The plan in 2002 is so long from now.
I mean, it's been a long time since now, 11 years ago, that when the plan for the traffic was made in 2009, it didn't really take in current information. It was looking at old information.
Precisely. So now they're in the process of updating the plan, but what they're doing now is to try to get the core rezoning action completed before the plan is completed. The plan will probably be completed early next year, so it's just a matter of a couple of months. But what it's going to mean is that if Coa Ridge gets rezoned, then they're going to redo the plan, but it doesn't make sense to redo the plan if you think that Coa Ridge should not be part of the urban growth boundary.
So at this point, what you're urging them to do is to stop and to do the traffic plan again first?
No, what we're asking them to do is to revise the Central Oahu Sustainable Communities Plan and then consider the zoning.
Okay, so you're talking about a two-step process.
Two-step process, and there would be a more up-to-date context to basically evaluate the zoning.
And how much more time do you think that's going to add to the process?
Probably less than 6 months, frankly.
And does that seem to be palatable to the board?
To our board, yes. To the city council, probably not.
So for 6 months, you're saying that it's foolish not to take a look at real issues with traffic and not use old information, and it seems to you that they just want to push it through.
Exactly.
So how do you get through an impasse like that?
Well, I mean, you keep fighting. I mean, our board has been consistent in terms of our stand that we're not against the development. We want the traffic impacts to be mitigated, you know, we want the planning process to be followed, et cetera, and we've been coming up with resolutions since day one on all of these things, and, fairly decent detail, et cetera. So, I mean, you know, you just do it till it stops, right? Coa Ridge had to go before the Land Use Commission first to get the reclassification from agriculture to urban, and we intervene as a party in that particular deliberation, so we're fairly well cognizant of what the issues are from the state level as what the issue was from the county level.
Castle and Hook, though, says that it's been working to mitigate those traffic issues.
Well, no. See, what the problem is, they can mitigate the traffic issues around the development, which is their responsibility, such as building interchanges, providing traffic lights, et cetera. But the problem is it's really downstream, okay? So there's no regional infrastructure. We have no rail, right? And because of that, we're not adding capacity from Mililani to downtown or to Kapolei where people work. And as a result of that, no matter what Castle and Cook does with respect to Coa Ridge, you know, the travel times are going to increase, which is right now for like an hour, 15 minutes, to what they say will be 2 hours each way going into town. Now, the problem with that is that's only a distance of 17 miles. And the notion of spending 4 hours a day in your car to go a total of 34 miles is really doesn't make a lot of sense to those of us who live there.
At this point, where you're trying to make the point that the downstream issues are just as important as what happens with those 3,500 homes and the development itself, is anybody listening to this argument?
Yeah, they are basically. What the State Land Use Commission did, for example, see, basically what we've been advocating for years is the notion of concurrency. Only allow so much development to be built that doesn't have an adverse impact on the people living there. Basically, yeah. So what the Land Use Commission did, they said, well, Castle and Cook, you must come up with a Pineapple Road interchange on H2 to take care of the traffic which would be generated from your particular development. And what normally happens in this case is that they'll postpone that to the last minute because it's a very expensive project. What the Land Use Commission did, they said, okay, you can do it, but you can only build like 1,800 homes. And after 1,800 homes, if the interchange is not there, then you have to stop building. So that's called concurrency, right? And then they also have something like 328,000 square feet of commercial space also.
So at this point, it's going to go to the council for, what, the second of three required votes?
Right, and my understanding there is that the hearing will be on October 31st.
So they've moved it because originally it was going to be earlier.
Right.
So now there's more time for people to weigh in?
Yes, exactly. In fact, I would encourage people to look at the Sierra Club website, which has all sorts of petitions and all sorts of, you know, perspectives from their point of view, and you can talk to your council person, et cetera, to do that. And then if you're interested, come to the hearing on the 31st and tell them how
right
you feel.
But, Dick, what is it that you think would be a viable solution? If you're saying that, you know, the development is okay, but we've got to take care of the traffic issues, what do you see as a planner that needs to be done?
Well, one, there is no rail line that's scheduled to go there. And if we ever were to have one, by the time it would be built, it would probably cost a couple of billion dollars, which means that it's not going to happen. But what we really need to do and what government agencies need to do, they need to plan better. So if we don't have a rail line, we will have access to the Pearl Highlands Station, which has parking for like 2,000 cars, I think. So if we can improve that access from Kauka Boulevard, for example, that would help out greatly. Then people could take their cars from their homes, and they could go to Park and Rise. We have Park and Rise where we live. There's some at Central Regional Park. Then you could catch a bus there. Mm. And this would be an express bus, which would take you through this dedicated lane going from Kauka Boulevard up to the Pearl Highlands Station, get dropped off there, and then just take the train into town. Right. So there are things that can be done, but the notion of concurrency would be to, you know, just be honest about it. This number of housing is going to cause an increase of your travel time of so much. Make a determination as to what is acceptable, what is not.
All right,
maybe
Dick,
it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes. We don't know.
I'm sorry to have to stop you there, but the bottom line of it is it's doable, but it has to be done and not just simply put out there as if, well, we'll handle that one down the road because it's going to be a fairly immediate impact once that development gets going.
Precisely.
We'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
Thank you much. Bye.
Dick Poirier chairs and co-founded the Mililani Neighborhood Board 40 years ago. He was a planning program manager for many years with the state. Now he'd like the city to follow correct procedures to accurately study the impact of traffic in rezoning Coa Ridge. The next meeting to vote on the rezoning happens later this month on the 31st.
In today's backyard quiz, we asked you about a Kaimuki landmark that was established in 1955 as St. Louis Junior College by members of the Society of Mary, the Marianists. The order was founded in the early 19th century by a French Roman Catholic priest who had been persecuted for his beliefs during the French Revolution and sought new pathways for the church. His vision called for the establishment of small, faith-based communities that emphasized education. Members of the Marianists founded schools in Dayton, Ohio, and San Antonio, Texas. Their founder's name was William Joseph Chaminade, and when St. Louis Junior College became a four-year institution in 1957, it was given the name Chaminade College. When the school added graduate programs in 1977, it became Chaminade University. I'm Chris Vandercook. It's 8:47, and that's our backyard quiz for today. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Dave Lawrence, and this is Stargazer, our weekly guide of what to look for in our island skies. We're joined by Sean Lotch from the Emilo Astronomy Center, our official conduit to the research community at Mauna Kea Summit. Hey, Sean, aloha. What are we looking for this week at Stargazer?
Aloha, Dave. Greetings from Mauna Kea. First quarter moon is on Friday, rising in the east at noon and setting in the west at midnight. This week, there are some nice pairings of the moon with planets. Tonight, the moon will be just below Saturn, while tomorrow night, it will be just above Venus. Mercury is at its best this month on Wednesday night in the western sky at sunset, and Jupiter will rise around midnight, with Mars rising around 3 a.m., both in the eastern sky.
What do we have on tap in terms of things that are unusual we might only see this week?
Well, we have another meteor shower. Thursday, look for the Taurid meteor shower. This shower should yield somewhere between 5 to 15 meters an hour, and the best time to look is between midnight and 2 a.m. in the eastern sky. October is a great month for meteor showers, with this being the second one of the month, and we have one more to go next week.
So, Sean, these historically must have been documented since they occur every year, going back hundreds of years.
That is correct. People basically notice that these same showers turn up all the time, and they record them, and that's why every year we kind of know to look for them in advance. The numbers vary a little bit each year, but we do have some averages, which is usually what we state in terms of numbers.
And how about things like the ISS or X-37B, any of that going on?
Tonight, you can look for the Cygnus spacecraft from 6:28 to 6:31 p.m., moving from west to north. Tomorrow night, look for the International Space Station from 6:58 to 7:01 a.m., moving from northwest to west. And Friday night, catch the X-37B from 6:54 to 6:59 p.m., moving from northwest to southeast.
Who runs that Cygnus one you're talking about?
So the Cygnus spacecraft is basically a refurbishment craft to the International Space Station. It's a private group that put that together and launched it to help bring supplies to the space station.
Is that SpaceX?
Yes, sometimes called SpaceX.
Okay, wow. Getting informed on the program today. Thank you so much, Sean.
Mahalo for having me, Dave.
You're quite welcome. Sean Lotch, Emilo Astronomy Center on the Big Island, and I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next time here on Stargazer.
If you'd like to get in on the ground floor, this next conversation is for you. She calls them the turning points that divide the past into comprehensible chapters, the historical epochs lasting millions of years that signal major changes to life on Earth. Science writer Elizabeth Colbert says we're at the beginning of a new epoch, the Anthropocene, one where we have altered our environment permanently in ways that will affect the planet long after we're gone. She's coming to talk at UH next week, and she joins us by phone from New York. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Morning, or afternoon by me, actually.
Yeah. This is a relatively new term, and roughly when does it date from, this epoch?
The epoch or the term?
The epoch itself.
The epoch, well, that's an interesting question. That hasn't precisely been decided. Some people would argue that it began with the Industrial Revolution about 1800, say, and some people would say it's more recent, sort of post-World War II with a great expansion of population and fossil fuel use that came after World War II. And another group, a smaller group, I guess, would say that it's actually even older. It's much older than that, that people have been altering the planet really for thousands of years, sort of 10,000 years since we invented agriculture and really started changing the landscape. So that's actually a matter of pretty serious scholarly debate right now.
Well, we certainly started altering the planet as soon as we got our hands on it, but you know, at least up until fairly recently, there were parts of the planet that were somewhat pristine. That no longer is true, is it?
If you know how to look, if you know what you're looking for, you can find evidence of human impacts. You're absolutely right. You can find them absolutely everywhere. You will find nuclear fallout everywhere. You will find a change in the composition of the atmosphere everywhere, a change in the composition of seawater everywhere. So, yes, there's no place you can't go to find human impacts now.
And with that, Elizabeth, with the changes that man has wrought, they're all pretty destructive changes, aren't they?
Well, I think that, you know, to use a sort of, I mean, they are changes. I guess one of the points that people would make is that they are rapid changes, so whether or not they're destructive or not is maybe a little bit of a value judgment, if that makes sense, but the key thing is that they're very rapid changes. They're much faster than organisms are used to. In the normal sort of geological course of history, change occurs very slowly, if at all. And so when you take, for example, as we're doing by, you know, burning fossil fuels, we're taking carbon that took hundreds and hundreds of millions of years to deposit as fossil fuels, and we were burning it, you know, in a matter of decades, centuries maybe, but very, very fast.
And so geologically, there isn't a lot of precedent for these.
Understanding
the effect of these rapid changes, right?
Exactly, and then to get to the destructive idea, you know, destructive. So you're an organism that, you know, evolved over millions of years of relatively stable, let's say, ocean chemistry, and then all of a sudden it changes. The odds that you can adapt that quickly are very low.
Well, not to wax too apocalyptic here, Elizabeth, but when you do, it just seems inevitable that the changes that have been brought about to the environment are in the nature of nuclear presence, radiation, global warming. None of them are going anywhere good, are they?
You'd be sort of hard pressed to find one where you'd say, "Well, this is going to have a happy." This is a happy one, as I say, for most of the other organisms with which we share the planet. Now, let's take an example. For example, we now produce a lot of nitrogen that, I mean, we're not producing nitrogen, we're producing the kind of nitrogen that it used to be only produced by nitrogen-fixing bacteria. We now do this in our fertilizer plants. We basically fix nitrogen, we dump it on our crops, we put it on our fields, and we grow a lot of food.
Mm-hmm.
So from our perspective, that's been a, you know, really positive change. Now, from the perspective of the rest of the planet, of the rest of the organisms on the planet, it's not so clear.
Well, one of the characteristics of the anthropo end of the term, that humanity is affecting the planet, is humanity has a way of doing things like dumping nitrogen without regard for future consequences, especially thinking long-term in geologic time. Right.
Yes, we're not. Interestingly enough, we're not really very attuned to the distant future. And even though people are being told nowadays constantly the things that we're doing that will have, you know, a very clear. We just have a very clear idea now. For example, what continuing to burn fossil fuels is going to do not that long from now. You know, but probably beyond the end of many of our lifetimes. How's that? And we're really not taking any action to try to ameliorate that. And so the question of whether we really are long-term thinkers or not is an open one. Let's just put it that way.
Well, let's hope it gets answered satisfactorily, Elizabeth.
Yes, let's hope so for our kids' sake.
Thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer for The New Yorker who'll be speaking at UH on October 10th. Her topic, Welcome to the Anthropocene. Details are at hpr2.org.
Aloha, Michael Titterden here. It's time for the Fall Fundraiser Celebration 2013, which begins October 16th. And just why is HPR worth your time and even more your support? For a little while now, we've been on a quest together to build a robust, locally operated public radio service which offers not just one but two first-class streams of programming dedicated to news, culture, and ideas. It's an ambitious goal for a community of our size, but one which your forethought, passion, and loyalty have nurtured and are helping to bring to full realization. So, what's HPR all about? It's all about things that matter. Thank you for your support.
Beth Ann, we talked on something, touched on something in that last talk with Elizabeth Colbert about the human being's tendency to postpone solutions, that we create problems that we expect succeeding generations to solve, and we can no longer do that. We've kind of reached critical mass in that area.
So many scientists tell us, but whether we actually do something about it or continue to talk about what we should do about it, that's sort of where all the questions lie.
One of the concerns that I always have when I talk to scientists, and I always ask them, is there a real anti-science movement in this country? Because we seem to find it very easy through internet rumors and other just word of mouth to deny scientific evidence these days. I find that troubling.
And many scientists are telling us that they find it troubling as well, because once upon a time, science was at the bedrock of what this country was trying to do, particularly in the 50s
reasons.
And 60s.
Yeah.
So we'll be talking about that in successive shows. Thanks so much for joining us for this Monday. And that's going to do it for us. Up tomorrow, though, another run at the Bills to keep sidewalks clear of homeless tenters.
And we'll continue the jazz talk with a versatile local musician who's moving into a challenging arena, the glories of big band music.
Meanwhile, talk back where we can hear you. You can continue the conversation with us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or get me at BecauseHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information about topics and guests, check the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.